But I have always thought that building your own business is too much work and you get too little in return. But I actually changed my mind.
This is Female Business Angel Podcast,
your go-to destination if you're a business angel or would like to get into angel investing and don't know where to start.
Or if you just want to find out how we tick. We're Tina and Katja, both business angels from Berlin. Well, I'm a VC now. We will interview established female business angels about how they got started and how it is going, including all the best tips and tricks.
So get ready for some insider stories and personal empowering moments and revelations with these incredible women.
Welcome to this journey with us.
Hi, Stina.
Hi, great Katja.
Great to have you on our podcast. We've already had a brief chat, but now it's a longer session. It's an honor to have our first angel from the Nordics representing Denmark.
Exactly.
At the Female Business Angels podcast. We are at the Scene Studio. Scene is a pre-seed fund from Berlin. We are here in Berlin, Prenzlauer Berg, in the beautiful studio on the roof. We're super happy to be here. And we would love to know more about yourself, your journey, and how you became a business angel, entrepreneur, and book author. Introduce yourself and please tell us how
you're doing. Well, thank you so much for having me here. And it's always exciting to share a little bit about myself and what I've been through. So yeah, so first of all, my name is Stina Sorensen, and I have just recently stepped down from my operational role as a COO as a health tech company that I founded 5 years ago. And so I've been transitioning into a more active business angel, which I obviously is spending much more time on now. Besides of being an angel investor, I also sit on several boards in energy companies, in different kinds of areas of sustainability as well. I'm also a strategic advisor for startups. So I spend quite some time with startups and I built a couple of myself as well. So I guess that's the short story.
Wow, this is really impressive. You've built a couple of startups. Which one are you the most proud of?
Well, I'm actually, my two big startups, I created quite a few companies, some with just a single purpose of being a vehicle for doing a project and things. But I mean, with Radiobotics, which is the health tech company that I created, we worked 5 years on solving substantial problems within the whole health tech area. And I really believe that that has some great impact. My company before that was a crazy Silicon Valley story, which I think I learned a lot from. But the impact we had wasn't that great, so to say, compared to actually trying to solve real-world problems in the healthcare sector, so to say. So I would say Radiobotics is what I'm most proud of.
This is like the recent one. Yeah. What was the not that important problem that you were trying to solve that took you to Silicon Valley, though?
Well, I mean, the Silicon Valley wasn't necessarily what I would call an important problem, but it was indeed a difficult technical problems. So what we were trying to do was to rethink how you were creating content. And this was 6 years ago. So you have to remember that this was when Snapchat and Instagram started taking off in its with the video formats and those things. So what we created was something quite substantial for the camera section. And we also was bought by one of the big companies that obviously make a living off cameras.
Mm-hmm. Wow, this is exciting. So I think your story is absolutely fascinating. Did you want to become an entrepreneur as a child and build these companies, go to the Silicon Valley, sell them, solve substantial health tech problems, improve the life of the humanity? Or did you want to become a business angel and sit on all these boards? Or what did you envision for yourself?
Actually, never. The last corporate job that I had was working at a global digital department at a very big pharmaceutical company. And I was thinking, this is exactly what I need to do. I need to work so you can progress, so you can, you know, raise in degrees and have more important titles and things. And that was really what I was set out to. And then 1.5 years in that position, I was really disillusionized, or how you say, because I was like, this was not what I wanted. But I have always thought that building your own business is too much work and you get too little in return. And but I actually changed my mind because I was thinking, being in the corporate world, if being in the corporate world gives you, maybe can give you access to some revenue, but it's too stable, it's too predictable, and you work so much, and in the end, there is not that many that actually cares when you're part of a big company. So it really, what changed my mind was that at the company I was at, there was a huge restructuring round, so a lot of people got fired, and that was obviously part of the plan. I didn't, and I had actually hoped to get fired so I could do something else.
Oh, no.
I didn't. So I was thinking, well, what is it that makes the decisions? What is it that actually makes these things move around, and who appreciates the time that you spend on this? And I actually came to the thought that nobody really, well, they do appreciate it, but personally, I didn't feel as I could just be anybody, right? So that was actually what led me to resigning from my job, and I went to traveling first of all to all of the big tech conferences in the world to see what is going on, what's happening, and that was where I actually met.
So not to the yoga retreat, Himalaya, but you went to the tech conferences.
Exactly, to re-educate myself and to tap into what is really happening out there. And I really been spending all my time with, you know, what is it that new technology can do. And on that travel through Hong Kong to Austin to Portugal to many places, I sort of ran into these camera guys that I ended up joining forces. And then, I mean, my startup journey really took off, and that's really what I've been spending all of my time on the last 7 years.
Wow, that's amazing. So the most groundbreaking conference was the one in Hong Kong.
It was actually because at that time it was very progressive and there was so much happening. Also, as we know today, how much China has actually done to, you know, be leading in terms of AI and a lot of technology. And you can really be afraid of what they're doing. And you can also try to understand more in depth of what is actually happening there. And joining that conference in Hong Kong at that time really gave me an insight into how big and how crazy and how how little we actually in Europe understand about what is going on in China. And I'm not necessarily praising what they're doing, because there is also a lot of challenges happening in the tech world there, but just to have an understanding of it was actually quite interesting at that time.
Absolutely. Which one, was it the one that Web Summit is organizing in Asia, or was it?
Yes, it was. Yeah, I can't. It's sometimes
Collision.
Yeah, it was Collision that was in Hong Kong, and they were running this program where they invited a lot of female entrepreneurs as well. So they were really pushing that more females attended these tech conferences.
They do that. Yeah, they do that for the Web Summit as well. It's 2-for-1, or sometimes they even invite ladies. And I must admit, this is like one of the few conferences where you really have the equal gender ratio.
Yeah. So, yeah, there's one of the few conferences where women have to stand in line for the bathroom, right?
For the bathroom, yeah, that's the downside.
Normally, in my early tech days, I really enjoyed that you could have the bathroom for free.
Yeah, that's true. That's what's happening in Web3 right now. So, yeah, women in Web3 and blockchain is very scarce. So. Yeah, so when you go to the conferences or to the after parties, you at least hope to not to have a line in the bathroom, and exactly. And mostly true for now, which is sad as well, because I mean, I would prefer to have an equal gender ratio, to be honest,
exactly,
everywhere in every industry. But yeah, I really love your story. So it was like gradually realizing, okay, if you don't show up to work, they would just hire someone else, and it's a big corporation, and someone else can do it. And it's better to, to like pull the plug and reset, get inspiration, bump into more entrepreneurial minds and join forces with them to build something life-changing and to go on a ride, to go on a journey, which turned out to be very rewarding for you.
Yes, it turned out, but I had no plan.
yeah, but this is super cool. I guess, yeah, this is the question for many people out there. So when should you continue with your corporate job? For how long? When should you, like, how do you realize, how long should it take you to realize, okay, maybe it's not for me. Maybe I should try try the like the startup slash investor track?
I also think it's not one or the other. I see myself as also I could potentially take on another corporate job in maybe 5 years or 10 years. And I sort of see that, you know, how you have, where you have your energy and where you are in a situation in your life where you can take more risks and where you sort of is set up for doing other things. So I really think it's something that changes and you can go back and forth between creating a business, spending 5-6 years on those things, and then maybe finding a new route for your startup, and then you can go back into corporate life. So I also think it, at least for the young ones, it should be seen as two things that can actually complement each other rather than it has to be one or the other.
Yeah, I absolutely agree. It's like a phase in your life. Yesterday, I met with friends who are working, of course, in the startup scene here in Berlin, and they were telling me about having a bit of a midlife crisis and thinking that it would actually be nice not to come up with another startup idea or to, you know, land like another one of these cool dream jobs, but maybe to do something with your hands, like to become a woodworker or fireman, to set up like, I don't know, an exclusive Airbnb business or just to do some gardening, which I thought it was also a very refreshing perspective. And I heard it from many young people as well, like setting up. Growing your own food and becoming self-sufficient. So this is super exciting. And how did your family and friends react? Because you completely changed your life, like in the course of like 1 year.
Well, I think one of the things that I feel very fortunate about is that even though my family doesn't necessarily understand what I'm doing, they're very supportive. So every time I've been presenting new ideas and things for instance, for my grandma, she's always been, of course, I mean, I'm sure you can succeed with those things as well. So even though she probably not understood what it was, then they have always been very supportive of what I've been doing and where I've been living and how I've been traveling around and those things. So I feel very, very fortunate. I have a sister that's 3 years older than me, and I sometimes call her the boss in my life, and I ask her for advice very often. She always says yes, so sometimes I even just call her because I know she would say yes. So
that's really cool.
in that sense, I've been very supportive from my family and friends also, and sometimes I think they are too they're too positive on my behalf, because they always look at me and think that I will probably figure out something. And that is probably true. But sometimes I think to myself, you know, what if not? What if it wasn't supposed to go really well? But I still have to experience that.
You can always call them and ask.
Exactly.
Advice.
Yeah.
You know,
hopefully
to your try. Yeah, that's really good to have support and people.
It is,
believe
it is
in you.
Very
that
important.
Gives you wings and power, I guess, superpowers to
it does.
Keep
I mean it's not something that sort of, you know, in your day-to-day operational business that you can sort of feel, but when things are starting to change and you need to act and you need to do something and things are going up and down in startups, right? So when things are going down, you obviously start to reflect on what's happening and what could the consequences be. And there it's very nice to know there is support, but obviously you don't feel it in an everyday setting, right?
No, yeah, but you know, it's there. It's really good. And so tell us about your very, very first angel investment. Do you remember how it happened? What was it, like a coincidence? Or did you decide, okay, I would love to be an angel investor and make my first ticket?
Yeah. Again, I didn't necessarily decide what the end goal should be, but I was sort of a little bit looped into it. So it was right after the acquisition of the camera company had happened, and I was about to start Radiobotics with a friend of mine. And I met these guys that had created Nordic FinTech Angels, which were a group of four people that had come together. They wanted to invest in FinTech in the Danish ecosystem. And they actually asked, they were at an early stage, so I could still join. And I actually joined it was just a company that was working on doing, you know, things on the side, so to say. And so I actually joined that, and I did immediately after I did my first investment in a company called Meta, which creates algorithms that can sort of screen investment portfolios for sustainability and ESG goals. So, and that investment was my very first. I'm still very active. I sit on the board of this company as well. They just raised another round and is still growing. I think they're around 25 to 30 employees today, and it's a big company. So I hopefully it looks like that my very first investment would also be very successful.
It's a good one.
Yeah. So I still very much remember.
Yeah.
Sorry, say it again.
How old is the company now? It's like 5 years.
I think they are four. So okay. It was in the very early stage. So that was in 2018. So they're maybe five years old today.
So like first money in.
Yeah.
That's great.
Yeah, we were some of the very first investments, if not the first. Yeah, it was very early. I mean, that's where you get most return on your, I mean, it's with the highest risk, but it's also with the potential biggest return. It is to get in very early, right? When you don't have millions to invest, right?
Yeah. What convinced you to bet on them?
I think it was, it's actually interesting. I really think that the idea that they had in terms of, you know, making sustainable investments much more transparent and providing the information. And at that time, there was very little information around sustainable investments. And so I really think that the mission they were on, and then it's really the people, right? I mean, the two guys that founded the company was very interesting to work with, and they really showed a lot of progression throughout the process. And I can see that is when you first time meet a founder until the next time, and if a lot of things has happened and you can see they're taking action and they're getting things done, it's very intriguing for a potential investment, because that's really what you would like to see to begin with, right?
So vision, mission, getting things done.
Oh yeah,
mentality, kind of roll up your sleeves.
Oh, for sure. I mean, all the usual suspects were there, so to say.
Yeah, absolutely. And so now you've done quite a few other angel investments, also together with other people, and you are scouting for equity ventures as well. So, how do you juggle all that? What did you learn also? Because, I mean, you are now an experienced business angel and entrepreneur. So
what did I learn? I mean, you learn that things change all the time. So there is always room to learn something different. I really think that what I have seen and what I find very, very valuable is that I both have been on the founder side. So I've negotiated these angel investment deals as a founder, taking money into my company. And I've also been sitting on the other side negotiating as an angel investor, and having that both sides of the table and understanding both parties. I think that is very valuable in what I do. I am very much a founder investor, so to say, because I always take the party of the founders. I can see that because I can really relate to myself. I've even advised some not to take an investment from one of my at an early stage, because I think as a founder, they would actually be better off doing something different. And so I can really see myself as one that has a founder perspective, and I would probably always take their party because I have been there and I know how it feels.
As a founder's ally, although now you're representing a pretty big VC fund.
Yeah. I obviously have to think there are different kinds of vehicles and instruments and things that you can do. And you obviously have to take that into consideration. But I'm also thinking, I do believe that by protecting the founders and ensuring you make a fair deal, you also are set out to make a much stronger business in the future as well. So I actually think it pays off, but obviously you have to be considerate about what you say yes to from both sides, right?
Yeah, absolutely. But yeah, I think it's great. It's a great combination that you're bringing to the table. And also, like, you being a communication professional, right? So besides being a founder and an experienced investor.
Yeah.
So I think we've recorded recently another episode with also a founder who is scouting for Atomico. So it's a bit of a similar profile. And we were talking a lot about the art of the storytelling, like when raising the money, when like dealing with investors, when growing your business and bringing it forward. So about telling your story as a startup, but also telling your story as an angel investor, as a founder.
Mm. Yeah. Because now you sit on the angel perspective, you sort of have to, in a very short way, show that you bring, you know, expertise to the table, and you can be part of moving the company from a very early stage to a a sort of a much stronger stage where they can actually be able to raise more money, right? So that you have to communicate in a convincing way, I would say.
Yeah, like your USP as an angel. That yeah, they exactly. Through in all the interviews we've done, like for this podcast, we've done 17 or 18. This is like this year's project, passion project. So it's absolutely, it's like know your value and what you bring to the table. And what would you say, from which like series or stage of the company do angels become redundant? So would you say is it so they join the company very early? Maybe they are the very first believers in the founders. They bring along other angels, other funds, other VCs. And then what would you say they kind of leave after, I don't know, Series B or something like that? Or how is the relationship evolving?
It really depends. Because it depends on the person as the angel investor. Because as an angel investor, you are a one-man show, so to say, right? So you really have to follow along. So it depends on can you follow along with continuing investments as they grow? Probably most cases not. But if you are a very wealthy angel investor, you can follow along. That means that you are relevant as from an investment perspective, a good part of the journey. There's also something with the skills and what the company set out to do and what kind of challenges that they are facing. And if you have any expertise with those. So for instance, I can speak for myself and see myself that in the company with Meta, I have actually asked the founding team several times, do you think that I should still be on the board? Because obviously you are growing, you're facing other challenges, other very strategic opportunities. And do you think that this is the best constellation? But they actually have I keep being elected to the board because of my founder background, because I'm building companies myself, because I'm also working with companies like EQT. So you have the other understanding from the other side. So I also continue to be relevant in this board, right? So I really think it's a different scenarios, but I keep continuing asking upfront if they still think it's relevant and what kind of role they would like me to take in this. And I 100% understand that if they had grown outside of what I could bring. It's also important to note that some startups, they grow so fast within the first 6 months or 10 months or something that you can find the perfect angel investor and with the right expertise and exactly what you need. And then you completed all these things after 6 months or 10 months, and then they can make themselves redundant because you already done these things that you would, or the you use the expertise that you were looking for. So I really think that as an angel investor, you should just have these conversations up front and you should be very open towards where do you bring the most value. And sometimes bringing the most value is not being there. You can still have your money there and your investments there, but you should also think of that your presence is not necessarily making a good difference all the time.
Yeah, I agree. And what would you say? Should you stay in there like on the cap table up until the exit, or should you maybe exit earlier?
Well, that depends a little bit. I mean, personally, I would like to stay on the cap table till the end. But I also do understand while when you're doing, especially for Series A or Series B, you like to clean up in the cap table and you like to make sure there's not that many investors around and then you tend to buy out. But if you joined in the pre-seed and probably even earlier than that, then being bought out in the Series A or Series B is also a good return on your investment. So it's fair and I can really understand, and I'm here to support the company. And if you are in the way of a larger investment because some large VC funds would like to clean up the cap table, I shouldn't be in the way of it. And my investment would be way, way too small to defend any of those things.
Yeah. So it's always like founder friendly size, of course.
Exactly.
Yeah. And so two questions we always ask here at this podcast. So one would be, what would you recommend to women who would love to get into angel investments, but they don't have like necessarily so they don't have people coming to them like, hey, invest in my company. So what would you recommend them to do? How should they start?
If they come from having founded the startup world where they have founded a company themselves, I mean, they should really. You know, have comfort in that they have great knowledge about cap tables, investment vehicles, and how you can structure a deal and term sheets and all of those things. So when you come from the startup world, you probably have a lot of this knowledge. You just haven't thought of that you can actually go on the other side of the table and use it in a very, very useful way, right? if you don't come from the startup scene, or maybe if you come from the corporate world and where you're not so familiar with all these, technical parts of doing angel investments, there are many courses out there that can actually teach you in just in a week. You can know much more than some founders in a startup even does. So I think it's relatively easy to get into the lingo and to learn about, you know, the technicalities. One thing I think everybody that considers going into angel investments should think of is what is sort of the, what is your investment profile? That you should have conversations with yourself around what kind of companies do I actually like to invest in? What kind of things has to be in place? Does it need to be very early stage? So there need to be full, you know, at least a founding team, or do you feel more secure in a later stage? Because then you can see there is more of a team together. There's maybe a product. There's even maybe revenue in a company. And so you really have to think of where would you like to place yourself, and where do you feel most comfortable operating as an angel investor? So that's really what I think should be considered. And then you need to get out there speaking to the companies, because it's also like when you think of if you would like to have a new job, but you really don't know what you want, you will need to get out there, speak to potential people that can actually offer you exactly. Yeah. And so here it's also about speaking to these companies as well, figuring out what is it that you are actually intrigued by, where is it you believe that you can make an impact, and where do you think if you have the purpose of actually also multiplying your money, then also where do you think that potential lies, right?
Yeah, and also taking into account, it can be it's not a very liquid investment. It can take years, but it will not necessarily be a profitable one. But ideally, it is.
All my personal investments and also all of the equity that I take in terms of working with the startups, that is put in my pot as I believe it would be my pension. That is everything that it has to be there as a long-term thing. It has to be there as something that I would take a look at in 10 to 15 years and see, should I sell, or what should I do with it? So for me personally, all of this is a very long-term engagement.
Yeah, that makes sense. So yeah,
No, go ahead.
Yeah, you mentioned we get into the lingo and the slang of this cap tables and startups and angel investments. Which courses would you recommend? Do you have a couple of specific something tangible people could look into?
I actually don't know, because I've learned it the hard way of running a business myself. So I've learned it all. I've learned it all for my lawyers and for my investors and for reading through different kinds of investment opportunities. So, but I have actually looked a little bit into it. So I don't have a recommendation on this. Sorry. Besides learning it the hard way, but I've actually at some point I wanted to check out something, and I know for sure there are quite a few, and also some of those that are free to attend, and also some that you can actually learn quite a lot for 50 euros or something like that.
Yeah, right? We were also thinking about starting a couple of specific episodes.
From a founder's perspective, I know that Y Combinator, they have all of their the explanations in term sheets and all good examples of term sheets and those, they have a lot of those. So regardless of if you're a founder or an angel investor, there's a lot to find with the Y Combinator.
There is also a book called Venture Deals. It's by former Techstar SMD, I think, if I'm not mistaken. It's a good one to get started with.
Yeah. You answered your own question, Katya. You had the best. Yep. You had a better answer.
No, but I thought, there is not one single answer. I always look into, getting different perspectives and getting several answers and combining them. It depends. And then you pick what you need.
Exactly.
Yeah, that's really cool. But maybe we could should start a little academy for angel investment, for dummies.
Yeah.
And to get into it. And then the very, very last question. So it's a bit of a big one and philosophical one. So if you could change just one thing in our current world and on our planet, what would it be? And there are a bunch of problems to solve.
There's quite a few problems to solve. I mean, as a broader theme and a thing that I have seen is the is sort of the one thing that keeps us away from a lot of good things to happen is really that I think inequality, I really think that that's a huge challenge, and acknowledging and knowing that so few control so much and hold so much of the entire wealth in the world is really, I think that is a key to a lot of problems in today's society. And I also really think that a lot of startups is driven by changing inequality in many ways. So access to, democratic processes, access to knowledge, and access to sort of understanding your biases and how you act, and obviously also distributing wealth and those things. So I really, really think that if we could change inequality so we would be more equal around the world, I really think we could solve many problems with relation to food crises, access to health and gender equality and so on. So that's really one of the things that I see. And there's also, I can see something that I very much support in the work that I do is those working for changing inequality, so to say.
Yeah, I think it's a brilliant perspective, very Nordic one, but I have like 100% yeah. my buy-in on that one.
Yeah. And also acknowledging coming from a very privileged side of the world and having a lot of opportunities, you can also really see how inequality is just happening in front of you, right?
Yeah, I mean, it's not that it does not exist in the, you know, in the rich part of the world, but we are privileged. But as a woman also going to another part of the world, you realize I am privileged, but there are like other people that are more privileged. For example, men.
And exactly. They have
and you cannot do a business as a like, blonde woman in any part of the world, like you do in the US or in Europe, maybe. Or so it's also like a tricky realization. And I think that's a great mission. And I'm excited to follow your adventures and next projects, and also excited to meet you.
Likewise,
at some point. Thanks. Thank you so much for participating and for sharing your amazing journey.
And thank you for having me, Katja. Thank you so much.
Bye-bye, Sinem.
Bye-bye.
The biggest names in tennis are coming to Paris for the most anticipated Roland Garros in years. Tennis Channel Plus is your place to watch. Stream every court from your phone or smart TV live in HD. Experience 3 weeks of unparalleled tournament access as the world's top players in tennis face off against each other. Will the veteran champions continue their dominance, or will a fresh face emerge to challenge their legacy on the clay courts? Daily live coverage of this epic showdown begins Monday, May 20th. Don't miss a matchup. Stream it now with Tennis Channel Plus to be there when it happens.
My business used to be weighed down by the complexities of in-person payments. Then, Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe came along and changed everything. With Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe, I streamlined my payment process effortlessly. Now I can accept in-person, contactless payments right from my iPhone. No extra hardware required. What's truly remarkable is how I can cater to all of my customers' payment preferences. Whether they're using cards, Apple Pay, or other digital wallets, Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe ensure a smooth checkout experience every time. And it's not just me. Stripe helps businesses of all sizes, from local markets to global retailers, scale quickly and stay agile. To learn how Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe can help grow your revenue and reach, visit stripe.com/tapiphone.